Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Sebastian Malaby, who is director of the Maurice R. Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies and the Paul A. Volcker Senior Fellow for International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is More Money Than God, Hedge Funds and the Making of a New Elite. Sebastian, welcome to Berkeley.
Nice to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in London. But my raising is a complicated story because my mother's French. My father was a diplomat, so we spent some time in New York. You can tell that from my accent. Some time in Moscow, some time in Germany, in fact, two or three times in Germany. So it was a bit of a mixture of the product of East-West relations, the Cold War. That defined my upbringing.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world? You may have already answered that question, actually.
It created a curiosity about the world. I was determined not to just live in England all my life. And as it turned out, I've lived in England very little of my life. I've been in the United States now for 15 years, and I lived in Japan before that, and some in Africa as a foreign correspondent in Zimbabwe and Southern Africa. So that was the principal focus. The influence of my parents was to make me not a little Englander, but a large Englander.
Mm-hmm. And where were you educated?
Well, I went to schools in England, and I went to Oxford University. And as I left Oxford, I had two offers. One was to be a career foreign service official, and the other was to do an internship at The Economist magazine. And I picked the second. And the internship became a permanent position, and that launched me on the career of writing and thinking about the intersections between policy and finance and doing it in an international way.
And were there any formative experiences earlier that kind of pushed you in this direction, economics/journalism, or did it just emerge out of your education?
Well, I'd actually done some economics at high school, and then decided I didn't like it and went off and did a modern history degree at Oxford, which was very focused on political philosophy and sort of the interaction between political ideas and sort of historical developments in the late 19th, early 20th century. But now I've sort of evolved through going to The Economist and learning more about finance kind of on the job, just being thrown into writing about asset management, how insurance works, how banking works. I was in Japan for 3 years writing about their banking crisis. And so basically by an education of asking questions, of hanging out with the people who do finance and just peppering them with questions. If I didn't understand something, I would just say, I didn't get it. Please explain it to me again, until I did get it. And so that's how I immersed myself in finance. And so I still retain what I had as a student, which is a fascination with the interaction between ideas and practitioners. And in a way, my book about hedge funds is exactly that. There's a body of academic finance literature, most famously the efficient market stuff, but also the derivatives from that, which kind of qualified it. And then there are practitioners who actually work in markets and try to implement some of these ideas. In some mm-hmm. cases, they preempt the ideas. And it's that mixture of the practical and theoretical, which has always grabbed me.
And how long did it take you to write the book?
Well, I had the idea for the book in 2006, so well before the financial crisis. And it took me about 3.5 to 4 years. I mean, partly because getting access to hedge fund managers mm-hmm. is something that people hadn't done before in a major way, with a couple of exceptions. And so persuading people who never gave interviews to give me an interview, and to give me, in fact, two or three interviews, and to spend lots of time with me with a tape recorder on, and then give me their internal documents from their hedge fund. And this was not a simple exercise. So it took about 3.5 years of diplomacy, of figuring out who did I know, who knew the people, who knew the real people. Mm-hmm. And so I had to be patient in getting the access I needed to really tell the story from the inside out.
And I should tell our audience, they should go out and buy the book, but the other thing is, this is really a history of hedge funds also, an evolution of what they were up to over time. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But you actually said something that I wanted to ask you about, because you said genius does not always understand itself, you said in the book. And I'm curious, as you did these interviews, did, in addition to telling you the nuts and bolts of what they did, were you left with the impression of that most of these hedge managers understood what they were doing?
Well, that quote comes from a bit where I think I invoke Vic Braden, the tennis coach, who did this exercise of asking professional tennis players what was it that made McEnroe's forehand so effective. And different tennis pros had different theories. McEnroe himself had a theory. And then you could test the theory against the truth by taking a film of the forehand and slowing it down into consecutive frames and seeing really when did he cock that wrist or move his weight slightly. And what was interesting is that the geniuses, the pros, didn't understand. They were wrong about what made the forehand so great. And in some of the profiles I write in my book about the history of hedge funds, there are hedge fund managers who posit one theory about why they did well. But when you really dig into the evidence, it's wrong. It just doesn't make sense. And, you know, my favorite example of this was Paul Tudor Jones, a sort of storied, trend-following macro investor who would invest all over the world in different currencies and commodities and anything he felt like. And he had this idea that he was making money because he was brilliant at looking at historical analogies. So if he thought, well, let's see, the S&P 500 has gone up for the last 5 days, the volume of trading has gone down for the last 3 days, gold is going this way, the dollar is going that way, and then he would say to his research staff, go find me the 6 cases in the past when these 5 conditions have pertained. And then he would look at the pictures that they brought to him and say, okay, so that's how these markets behaved in these past 6 examples. So I think it's going to do the same thing now. And that's how he says he made money. But I talked to lots of people who worked for him, including some people who did statistical tests on that proposition. And they found that the value it added, looking at these historical analogies, the value it added was negative, less than zero. He was losing money from this approach. And so the real reason he made money was something else. And then it became a kind of intellectual detective exercise to figure out the real reason why these guys made money.
Let's place for our audience hedge funds in the context. You say at one point, financial markets are mechanisms for matching people who want to avoid risk with people who get paid to take it on. Explain that and how leverage funds fit into that equation.
Well, I think it's a great question because, you know, there's a lot of skepticism, rather natural skepticism after the financial crisis, that, you know, what does finance do for anyone? Why do we even need all this complex modern financial innovation? And I think it starts with the idea that there always will be financial risk. You know, currencies will go up and down. Interest rates will fluctuate. There'll be difficult decisions to make about should you allocate capital to this biotech company over here or to that software startup over there. And financiers will get it wrong and they'll lose money sometimes. So there is risk. And the question is, where do you want to have it housed, right? And my argument in my book is that hedge funds over time have housed it very effectively. They've been better at absorbing this risk and really measuring it and being careful about how you manage it than other kinds of financial players. And that's a service to the economy. And if you think about an example of, you know, 2 American companies, one's an exporter and it's worried that the dollar will get too strong, because then it can't export. And then the other one's an importer, and it's worried that the dollar will get too weak, because then its import costs will go up and its business model will suffer. So these 2 companies, the exporter and the importer, could manage the risk by each of them holding a separate pool of capital as a buffer. But if every company in the United States did that, there would be enormous reserves of capital sitting in the bank waiting to act as a buffer. The cost of capital would go up because capital would be scarcer. So it's much better if the exporter and the importer meet each other in a futures market for the dollar, and they trade their equal and opposing risks off against each other, and the risk is netted out. But for that transaction to work effectively, you need intermediaries in the middle who are willing to take positions in the dollar and to be specialists in having a view on where the dollar is going. And that's the role of speculators. And I think the best speculators are to be found at hedge funds.
Let's talk about the tools at work here, because hedge funds short, that's key to what you just described. They also use leverage. help us explicate building on the model that you just gave.
Well, so it goes back to the first manager of the first hedged fund. He called it a hedged fund. His name was Alfred Winslow Jones. He set it up in 1949. And he was an interesting character, by the way. I mean, he'd been sent as a young man to Berlin, working for the State Department, and got involved with the anti-Nazi left. He married a German anti-Nazi activist. He ran these clandestine missions. He enrolled, funnily enough, in the Marxist Workers' School in Berlin, which is a funny place for the father of, you know, hyper-capitalist hedge funds.
This is a story that repeats itself in your book. A lot of lefties wind up...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, including George Soros, who was a speculator who was anti-speculation. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I found a document, actually, from the British authorities from the early 1930s back to Washington, to the State Department, saying, this young man, Alfred Winslow Jones, who keeps on coming to England, you know, is he really a Marxist, enrolled in the Marxist work? I mean, how dangerous is this guy? Should we arrest him? So he was thought to be a left-wing subversive, and although his German wife dumped him, and he went back to America and remarried an American woman and said to her, honey, you know, we should go for a honeymoon. I know what, let's go to the front lines of the Civil War in Spain, where, you know, they hung out with Dorothy Parker and Ernest Hemingway gave them a bottle of Scotch whiskey. Anyway, this was the character who set up the first hedge fund. And the tools, to come back to your question, the tools that he used included the hedging, which means that you bet on something's going up and something's going down. You bet on it going up by being long, by buying it. You bet on it going down by being short, which means you borrow the stock and sell it. So you're betting both ways. And when you do that, you don't actually mind if the broad market index goes up or down, because you're hedged. And now that you've hedged out that market risk, you can expand the other kind of risk that you're taking, which is a view that, let's say, you're long General Motors and short Ford, because you think General Motors is better managed than Ford. So you're making a specific judgment about the relative quality of the management of these two companies. And you've hedged out the worry about whether auto sales generally will go up. So now that you've taken a very specific risk, you can expand that bet by borrowing extra money, putting it onto that bet, without actually making your portfolio risky, because you've taken out so much risk through the hedging. And it's that combination of hedging and leverage which are common to not all, but many hedge funds that came later. And you can apply it to fixed income strategies and so forth.
Now, the prevailing idea, which you discuss in the book, that these hedge managers are working around and through, is the efficient market theory. What does that theory say markets are like, and what do hedge fund managers see that's not true about that theory?
Well, the efficient market theory says that markets have efficiently absorbed all the relevant information pertaining to the price of a stock or a bond. So smart people, the idea is, smart people who are investors have already gotten hold of all the information and figured it all out. And they, if it looks like it's irrationally high, you know, they've sold it and they brought the price down and vice versa. And so it's difficult to beat the market because all the information is already in the price. And if the security moves in the next 5 seconds, it's because new information has come from somewhere. And that's why it's moved. So you can't predict it because, by definition, if all the known information, all the existing information is in there, only something that's not predicted can move it. And therefore, that's related to the idea that movements are random. There's no correlation in prices. Just because it went up one day doesn't mean it will go up the next day. And that's basically a summary of the efficient market hypothesis. It became dominant in academic finance from roughly the mid to late 1960s. And it ruled the discipline until the mid to late 1980s, so about 20 years or so. And hedge funds are interesting because essentially they've made money by finding the qualifications, the kinks, the exceptions in the efficient market hypothesis. And so one early example is that actually the efficient market academics, they stipulated that there could be a few exceptions. For example, if liquidity was imperfect, meaning that if a very big seller of something would move the share price down, not because they're selling because they have a view on the fundamental value of the equity, but it could be, say, you know, an insurance company that had some investments and now it faces a claim, there's been a hurricane, it has to pay out some money. So it has to sell stock to raise the money. It's an information-free sale. And this big sale could knock prices off their equilibrium for a bit because liquidity is imperfect. So now along comes this hedge fund manager, Michael Steinhardt, who systematically milks that liquidity distortion, the fact that sometimes when big sellers come along, they do move prices. He gets in there and he takes the other side of the trade when the big institution needs to sell a big block of shares. And therefore, he gets that discount created by illiquidity and then sells back at the equilibrium price half an hour later.
When you go through your history in each chapter is the colorful story of a new hedge fund manager who emerges or who suddenly becomes very important because he's seen something new that works in the way you just described. So what I wrote down was that what you're really saying is they make money by anticipating structural changes in politics, economics, and even in society, I think. Is that a correct assessment? Because what the picture you paint, these people are really empiricists in a funny kind of way. They have their ear to the ground and they see things which always are places to make money.
Yeah, I mean, George Soros used to say, I don't just play the game, I look for changes in the game. Things that were going to cause something to move a lot. And that's what he was excited by. And so one good example of this was the 1992 European exchange rate crisis, which is kind of a precursor of the recent one we've had in Europe. But in those days, there was this thing, the exchange rate mechanism, which linked together the different currencies of Europe, didn't peg them, but put them in a narrow band so they could fluctuate a little bit, but not too much.
And this was part of the steps to creating a European
right.
monetary union, right?
That's right, that's right. And what George Soros and his chief portfolio manager, Stan Druckenmiller, figured out was that German unification had put intolerable strain on this system because the Germans had spent a lot of money on absorbing Eastern Europe, creating a danger of inflation. Because of that, German interest rates were very, very high. And high interest rates in Germany meant that the other members of this exchange rate system had to move their exchange rates up to keep capital in their country. Otherwise, capital would flee to high-yielding German bonds. And as it fled the pound or the lira, the pound or the lira would fall. That would be in Britain or in Italy. And it would fall out of the permitted band. So essentially, the Italians and the Brits and so forth had to raise their interest rates because the Germans had. And this happened at a time when they already had recessions, high unemployment. It was politically very painful to do this. And so what Stan Druckenmiller and George Soros figured out is that this particular game, which had been running for some years, was going to change. And that when it collapsed, when the system collapsed, the lira in Italy and sterling in Britain would fall out of the band, and they would fall a long way because it was kind of a pent-up, explosive potential for a downward move. And so they bet on that, and they were right about the change in the game. And they made, Soros famously $1 billion dollars on his bet against
And he said that he broke the pound. Was that the expression?
That's right, that's right. And in fact, it's a drama which I think is fascinating because it has echoes with the Lehman Brothers crisis of 2009, in the sense that the repetitive element here is that hedge fund managers have a different way of thinking about risk than policymakers frequently do. And so what happened in the British case in 1992 is that the Bank of England could see that they were going to be attacked by hedge funds if they tried to keep sterling inside this exchange rate band. And the hedge funds would be selling sterling. And so the Bank of England got lots of ammunition. They got a big pile of money. So they could buy the sterling as the hedge fund guys sold it. And on one particular day when sterling was under strain, they bought a heck of a lot. And they bought so much that they drove sterling up by 0.25% against the Deutsche Mark, and they thought, wow, we really showed those speculators today. But to George Soros and Stan Druckenmiller, this was a joke, because what it showed you was, on the day when the central bank attacks you with maximum ferocity, the most you can lose is 0.25%. Big deal. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, they were playing on the other side a game when they were going to win 15% or something if sterling bust out of the exchange rate mechanism. So think about it. It's not just that there's 50% chance of sterling breaking out or not breaking out. It's that if it does break out, you're going to get a 15% reward. And if it doesn't, you might be penalized to the tune of 0.25%. It's the asymmetrical nature of the payout that pulls the hedge fund guys in. And I think that's the same with Lehman Brothers in 2008, where
we go on, and then I'll have a question for you, but then Paulson made a decision about Lehman Brothers. Paulson, of course, had been a trader, but as you point out in the book, he acted in that case like a policymaker.
Yes, it's interesting. You know, Paulson had actually been a mergers and acquisitions banker. He'd been a corporate advisor more than a trader, actually, not like Bob Rubin, who was a trader, the other Treasury Secretary who came from Goldman Sachs. So, of course, you know, Hank Paulson had rubbed shoulders with lots of traders at Goldman. He wasn't naive about this. But I think it's a fair characterization of his mindset in that crucial weekend when he let Lehman go down, was roughly that he didn't like to bail everybody out. And he understood that when he bailed big institutions out, it created bad incentives for the future. People in Congress had already called him the finance minister of China, which would sting if you're a red-blooded capitalist. And so he didn't want to bail them out. And his view was, if he didn't bail them out, there was a 50% chance that the markets would sort of absorb this, okay, things would be flat. And sure, there was a 50% chance that the markets would go down. But he thought to himself, I think, 50-50, that's a fair chance to take. But then I went to see Paul Tudor Jones, this red-blooded hedge fund guy, and I said, well, how did that weekend feel to you? And he said, it's obvious. If 50% chance is that things are okay, that means it's flat. So if I bet that it will go down, I lose zero. But 50% chance, it's going to fall through the floor, in which case, if I'm betting it's going to go down, I make tons of money. So it's like playing roulette where, you know, if red comes up, they're going to give you a big payout. But if black comes up, you just get your money back with no penalty. Of course you're going to bet on red. Mm-hmm. And because you will bet on red, and because other hedge fund traders will bet on red, the Hank Paulson bet was bound to lose.
In both the case of Paulson and going back to the British crisis in which John Majors was the prime minister and he made the crucial decision about what to do with the pound, you're pointing to the fact that the politicians have an entirely different incentive structure than participants in the market under the efficient market theory. So Major was holding out because he wanted to bring in the members of his coalition to agree to the devaluation, and he wasn't going to do it no matter how much money Soros might make.
That's right. So on the crucial day, there's a very good description of this whole episode from the government standpoint, from the finance minister in Britain at the time, Norman Lamont, who was in charge of the kind of let's keep sterling in the exchange rate band campaign. And he describes, you know, having agreed with the Bank of England that they would intervene very, very heavily the day after the day I just described. You know, they intervened heavily one day, they got it up by 0.25%. The next day it fell, and then I think that the third day, which was a Wednesday, they came in, sterling having been battered the day before, and they said, right, now we'll really show them, we'll give them all we've got. And he basically, you know, they had both an interest rate hike and a lot of buying of sterling in the markets to try and drive its value up. And Norman Lamont, when the policy was announced and the buying of sterling began, he went into his antechamber where there was a screen showing sterling's value. And as the interest rate hike was announced, the screen showed sterling like this, flat. It was like the heart rate monitor in a hospital. The patient was
flat
dead.
Flat line.
And so he knew on Wednesday morning that the game was up, that they hit them with all the ammunition they had, and just the markets were too big, they were going to overpower them. But to persuade John Major, the Prime Minister, to authorize sterling's devaluation took him until that evening, because John Major needed to convene a meeting with his cabinet colleagues, make sure they kind of put their hands in the blood, that they would come in and discuss what would be the options now. What should we do? Should we call the Germans and maybe negotiate for them to change their policy, or perhaps call our other European partners to put pressure on the Germans? And it was just a political exercise to cover John Major's back, because he was worried that the humiliation of sterling's devaluation would lay him open to a leadership challenge. He might lose his job. And for every hour that he delayed for political reasons, the hedge funds were making more and more money because they were buying sterling, I mean selling sterling, and the Bank of England was buying it, and the Bank of England was buying from them at a value that was going to be 15% off once the inevitable crunch came. So people say to me often, you know, you've written this book about hedge funds, you say that hedge funds make money. How can they make money in efficient markets? Well, here's one answer. When you trade against governments that are not in the market to seek profits, but rather there for political reasons, of course you can make profits.
So what we're seeing in your history is over time, using computers, using new kinds of data, responding to economic and political change, and especially structural change, the hedge fund managers can move money. And you're arguing that they can make the market more efficient because their incentives and their structure make them contrarians, you call them.
Yes.
So that's the plus, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, but over time, the first question that comes to mind, because they are in the business of just making money, are they turning the market into a big casino? That is, that functionally they can be contrarian, but at a certain point, as they make bigger and bigger bets, does it become about making a lot of money, which then can lead down the road unintentionally to collapse?
Well, I'm not claiming that there's no risk of a collapse. That's not my thesis. My thesis is that there's less risk of a collapse when you've got hedge funds doing this stuff than if you've got other kinds of institution. Because the big institutions, the too big to fail banks, the too big to fail investment banks, the too big to fail insurance companies like AIG, even the money market mutual funds, which sound anodyne but actually were key to the financial crisis in end of 2008. You know, all of these institutions have been bailed out at taxpayer expense. And the difference is with hedge funds is that although long-term capital management, a hedge fund which blew up in 1998.
And which was run by two Nobel laureates, I guess, or at least they were on the management board.
They were on the management team, that's right. They weren't really running it, but yeah. But that's right. So that's the most famous hedge fund blow up. And in that case, the Federal Reserve Bank in New York got worried enough that they kind of convened the meeting at which private bankers agreed to recapitalize the hedge fund. But there's never been government money put in to bail out a hedge fund. And that's a very important distinction. And I think it creates better discipline on the hedge fund managers. Also, these guys have their own money in the fund. They have their skin in the game. If they lose money, it's their own money to some degree. So it's not a guarantee that hedge funds won't do something dumb. Of course they do. But they are less prone to doing dumb things than the other financial actors. And so I think that since we do need to go back to what I said at the beginning, there will be financial risk. It does need to be housed somewhere. My claim is that it's better housed in hedge funds than in other kinds of institutions that have less good incentives.
Now, in the 90s, at the time of the crisis in Mexico and Russia and then in Asia, and I want to talk about the Asian crisis in a minute, Time had a picture on its cover, which we saw a lot of during the collapse of Summers, Greenspan, and Rubin, and Masters of the Universe.
Committee to Save the World.
Committee to Save the World and so on. But a point that you're making very powerfully in these stories is that these masters, and not just the Americans, the Committee to Save the World were losing control over time, that as we saw in the British crisis and so on. So this is a place where the game becomes problematic if our faith is in governmental policy makers at the national or the international level. What do we do with that conundrum? In other words, is the answer, well, we're still in a capitalist system and, you know, that's the way it is.
Well, you know, you're getting at the sort of the hardest question at the heart of all of this, which is, you know, what do you do about finance? How do you regulate it? Can you trust in private financial companies to manage risk sensibly? Obviously not, right? That was the message of 2008, 2009. It's disastrous to do so. But at the same time, can you trust in government regulators to prevent the private sector from getting it all wrong? Again, obviously not, because we've run that experiment too. Regulators were supposed to be regulating, and they failed. Now, sometimes people say, well, it's because they failed because Alan Greenspan had a libertarian philosophy and he didn't want to do regulation, and so the Fed was asleep at the switch. Well, I mean, you know, what about the SEC? Are you going to make the same claim about the SEC? Because they also failed. And what about the CFTC? They also failed. And what's more, not just in America. I mean, the British regulators had overhauled their system. They had the financial, the FSA, what it stands for. But anyway, that's their kind of SEC in Britain. It was thought to be a model regulator. Completely failed. And regulators in continental Europe, same thing. There's not much libertarianism, I can tell you, in continental Europe, but the regulators totally failed to restrain the risks of their banks. So in other words, there is neither perfect behavior in the markets with private institutions nor with government regulators. So my argument is we need to be a bit more subtle about how we seek salvation here. We can't say either I'm for markets or I'm for regulation. You've got to kind of look for the sweet spot. And I think, you know, hedge funds, where you get the incentives of the private sector guys right, that if they mess up and they lose money, it's their own money. They care about that. That's got to be part of the solution. A pure regulatory response is misguided because we've tried to regulate before and it's just very difficult.
There's one, before we talk about the collapse and your proposals for reform, there's one point that I want to touch, which is in the Asian crisis. We saw in the case of George Soros the kind of the combination of brilliance and ambivalence, so that he didn't go out to make all the money he could as these dominoes fell in Asia, because he has both he's both a gambler and a capitalist, but also a man who wants to change the world and the behavior of governments. Talk a little about that, because what happens when these charismatic managers embrace, as in the case of Soros, kind of different values than you would expect? Yeah. Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? I mean, if you're a liberal, you think it's a good thing, but...
Well, you know, this is absolutely fascinating to me. I mean, George Soros is the most gloriously schizophrenic individual. A schizophrenic, I think he acknowledges himself, by the way, that he has multiple personalities. He's both a philosopher, he takes that very seriously, and a philanthropist come statesman, and a speculator. So he's got a tripartite personality, and that's the richness of the man. And so the way it comes up in the Asian crisis is that in Thailand, his fund made $1 billion by betting that the Thai currency would collapse. And in betting, of course, they hastened the collapse. And the Soros team was quite ambivalent about this. I mean, they had debates and sort of late-night drinks, and they wrestled with whether this was good for the world or not. And the consensus they came out with was, it's okay to be a speculator betting against the Thai currency because Thailand's running fundamental economic policies which are not sustainable. The reason we would bet against the currency is because these guys have a current account deficit and a fixed exchange rate, and those two things can't last for very long. So we're usefully sending a message that the government needs to change its policy. That was their rationale. And I actually agree with that. I mean, I think that if you take the Greek sovereign debt crisis recently, for example, if only we had had more hedge funds betting against Greece 3 years earlier, because then they would have had three less years in which to borrow absurd amounts and get the whole country too much into debt. But if you'll let me, I'd love to tell the story about Soros in South Korea, because that is the other side of the coin here. You know, after Soros had made this $1 billion in Thailand, you know, the next thing that happened was that Indonesia collapsed, and then Malaysia got into trouble with its exchange rate. And then in November of 1997, the Soros economist based in Asia, Rodney Jones, went to South Korea. And he was visiting a South Korean finance company, and on the wall of the boardroom, he could see these sort of boastful announcements saying, we organized financing for company XYZ. And company XYZ was a Thai real estate company, which, you know, this guy had spent a lot of time in Thailand during the crisis. He knew these real estate companies. They were all bust. They were not paying any money back. So if the South Korean finance guys had lent money to them, they weren't getting it back. So how come they were still in business? So he pressed the hosts on this and said, well, so how come you're still here? And after some dissembling, the answer was, well, because the central bank has given us money under the table. And after having the same conversation at four or five different finance companies in South Korea, you know, it was obvious that the central bank had committed a large chunk of its reserves secretly under the table. And therefore, it had no ammunition left to defend the exchange rate. So the exchange rate in South Korea was going to collapse too. So the Soros guy sends a message to headquarters in New York saying, guys, here is the trade. $1 billion you can make. Just think about it. I mean, he might get 5% of that in his personal bonus at the end of the year. 5% of $1 billion is $50 million. You can retire on that, I think. So he is very excited. And the answer from New York when he sends this message is radio silence. Nothing. So he's more and more agitated. He sends a second message a couple of days later urging them to do the trade. And the answer is nothing. Radio silence. And then George Soros comes to South Korea, but not to do the trade. He comes to be a philanthropist. There's a red carpet reception at the airport. You know, he rolls out of the airplane and he says, speculators are bad. Here's how you fend off the bad speculators. I suggest the government does this and this. He went to visit the president in the presidential residence. And he wanted, just he decided that week would be philanthropy week. He didn't want to be a speculator. So I always wondered afterwards, you know, if I had been the economist who spotted the trade, how bitter would I have been about not getting that bonus? And I think the answer is I would have been bitter enough that if a writer had come to me 10 years later and said, do you know anything about what went on inside the Soros funds at that crucial time in the Asia crisis? I would have said, I do. And I've got 200 pages of real-time notes, and I will email them all to you right now, and I'll explain everything you want to know. And this is one of the many lucky breaks I had in terms of getting document dumps from inside hedge funds so I could really tell the story from the inside.
Now, I want to move to the 2008 crisis. And one of the issues that a program like this likes to deal with is clarifying for people, you know, who and how things work so we can understand it. And so the bottom line is you're saying here the hedge funds were not responsible for the collapse. Who was?
Well, I think they were not responsible for the collapse because actually in 2007 they didn't lose money. They were up by 10% when other people were losing a lot. And in 2008 they did lose money, but they lost half as much as the S&P 500 index went down. So there's the evidence. They managed their risks better than others, and they didn't get a government bailout. They cost taxpayers zero. Furthermore, very importantly, they cost creditors zero because whenever hedge funds get into trouble, they typically get closed down before the investor's money, the equity, is exhausted. So when it's down by about half, typically it just gets folded. So that means that the lenders don't lose anything, which is important in terms of the contagion you get. When lenders take a hit, they tend to pull in loans from elsewhere, and that creates the domino effect of contagion in the financial system. So hedge funds were much better for the system than all of the other players. And the other players include, you know, the investment banks, which were all out of business by the end of the year, either out of business or in the case of Morgan Stanley.
Lehman.
Yes, right. Merrill was bought by Bank of America because it was about to go bust. Lehman Brothers went bust. Bear Stearns was about to go bust, so it had a fire sale to J.P. Morgan. The two survivors were Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and they survived because the Federal Reserve agreed to give them access to their emergency lending and turn them into bank holding companies, right? So that's the story of the big five investment banks, and they clearly were at the heart of excessive leverage, too much borrowing, too much risk-taking, and too much packaging of crazy, complicated securities that nobody understood and that greatly exacerbated the trouble. So they're not the only bad actor. I mean, AIG, the insurance company, had a crazy sort of financial engineering group that agreed for some reason to absorb the risk of default on lots of credit securities by selling credit default swaps. And when the music stopped and the subprime market blew up, they were left with so many obligations to pay out on this insurance that they had to be bailed out by the government too. Citigroup, the biggest commercial lender, had to be bailed out. All of these small money market funds were, it turns out, behaving crazily, buying short-term debt paper from banks that weren't necessarily going to be able to pay them back. And so they had to be backstopped by the government. The credit rating agencies were not rating credit. They were just earning fees for looking the other way. So there's a long list of bad actors. And my point is that, you know, financial regulation is the needed response to all of that. And we've had that in Congress. But as well as looking at the stuff that didn't work and try to fix it with regulation, we need to pivot away and look at the bit that worked relatively well, the hedge funds, and say, how can we get more of the risk into these hedge funds? Because these guys seem to know how to manage it.
Mm-hmm. Now, help me understand something. Was AIG and Goldman Sachs doing? Had they created hedge funds within their organizations, or were those not really? Were they so different that we can't call them hedge funds?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's a blurry definition of hedge funds. If you put, you know, four or five experts in a room, you might get six or seven definitions mm-hmm. of hedge funds. I think that, you know, my case in favor of hedge funds is a case in favor of entrepreneurial, freestanding boutiques. It's not a case in favor of wacky trading inside too big to fail institutions, you know, that are going to be backed up by the taxpayer. I don't want those guys to be taking crazy risks because I'm underwriting them through my taxes. So I think, you know, what Goldman Sachs does with its proprietary trading is probably something that needs to be reined in and is being reined in under the reform. AIG, an appalling case of the regulator backstopping something which shouldn't have been, that kind of risk-taking shouldn't be going on in something which is ultimately insured by the government. So, you know, I think to the extent that I'm saying hedge funds are good, I'm saying freestanding hedge funds are good. We need to move the risk into the smaller entrepreneurial ones and out of the too big to fail ones.
But there are some elements of hedge fund activity that you want to regulate. You want limits on sort of a red flag or an alarm bell in the night if leverage is too great, if capital if there isn't enough capital and so on. Talk about what you have in mind.
Well, what I have in mind is that, you know, if you go back 50 or 60 years and you look at Goldman Sachs then or Lehman Brothers then, you know, these were small private partnerships managing their partners' own capital on an unregulated basis. They were basically like hedge funds. And they were not systemically problematic because they were too small. They were small enough to fail. But over time, the ones that did well of those partnerships from the 50s and so forth, they grew and grew and grew. And then at a certain point, they issue shares in themselves. And once you take an outside people's money, you're managing somebody else's capital. You're not so careful with it as when you're managing your own capital in a private partnership. So my point at the end of the book is that, you know, we've been here before. Private partnerships have morphed into dangerous systemic investment banks. And equally, private hedge fund partnerships will over time probably grow bigger. And although they're not mainly systemically problematic now, they will become big enough to be problematic in the future. We should be ready for that. So we should have a test of when you reach a certain size, you should get some questions from the regulator. And when you get to really big size, then you should be subject to being regulated like an investment bank, because that's pretty much what you've become.
I guess after reading your book, I've learned a lot, but I'm not sanguine about the future when we move beyond hedge funds and look at the global economic system. And so if we go back, for example, to the Asian crisis, the aftermath of that was the creation by countries of sovereign funds that are this huge commitment to funds which they then manage. And in the case of China, they, although I think their funds, they were doing this before the crisis, but they survived the crisis. Then they began loaning the money. So you created this great imbalance mm-hmm. Between surplus and deficit countries. Mm-hmm. How are we going to reform problems like that, which are an aftermath of the crisis, in the future? Because that the aftermath of that crisis, as I understand it, helped create the crisis of of 208.
That's right. And in fact, you know, you've just told one example, which I talk about a bit in my book, of a past crisis in which hedge funds were involved. And as you say, the solution to the crisis turned out to create a new problem, namely the problem of global imbalances and a lot of pressure actually just bubbling up in the last week or two around a kind of global competition to manage your exchange rate, which I think is very worrying and very destabilizing.
Which could lead to a beggar thy neighbor policy.
Yeah, as it did in the 20s and 30s, exactly. So we have now very good trade rules in the world through the World Trade Organization, which I think so far has managed to prevent trade wars, despite a very big recession. But what we don't have is rules around exchange rate management, and that's where I expect we'll see the most tension. And that's quite a worrying thing for the next few years. But you know, there are other examples in my book, too, of past crises which were kind of dry runs for the 2007-2008 crisis. And one is in 1994, when the Federal Reserve raised interest rates at the beginning of the year and was shocked to find that the raising of interest rates caused a massive dumping of bonds by the hedge funds, another sort of shadow finance, shadow banking system, that had stocked up on tons of... they basically used short-term low rates to borrow lots of money cheaply, and then they bought lots of bonds. And when the low rates were raised by the Fed, they dumped all these bonds. And so bond markets went into a spiral downwards. There was a global sell-off. Various small hedge funds from the time blew up. In fact, one of them was called Askin Capital. It was doing weird credit mortgage securities, in fact, in shades of 2008. Michael Steinhardt, who we mentioned earlier, was down 30%. Bill Clinton was on holiday in California. He got interrupted. He had to go out and talk to the press about what the heck was going on in bond markets. So we've been through these dry runs, and the policy consensus, after thinking carefully about what we should do, is that there were no good answers. That was the view after 94. That was the view again after Russia defaulted in 1998. And so people had thought about this before and found that there were no good solutions. And so we should be skeptical about the solutions that we've now put into place following the 2007-2008 crisis. Because intellectually, they're not very different to the ones that were not implemented before. And for some reasonable arguments, they were not implemented. So I guess the bottom line is, you know, the history, which I tell in the book, I think does support your skepticism about the future.
And what about the big problems that are out there? Looking at the United States, the increasing inequality, the extent to which that investment is not being made in productive enterprises that kind of point to new issues like the environment. The whole problem. These are not the focus of your book, but when we leave your book with a sigh of relief about hedge funds, and we are still left with a lot of these consequences: money slushing around for campaigns, increasing inequality. So, what I'm trying to say is the system can't right itself. And although hedge funds may be doing a positive function in markets and with markets, they're not addressing these problems. Do you want to offer us a sense of how this might all come together in the future in a way that would give us reform? And ironically, you're saying that in a way the best policemen were the hedge funds in the lead up to the 2008 crisis.
Yeah, I mean, on the policeman point, I think it's important to remember that to be a contrarian, to bet that the subprime bubble is crazy, you don't just have to be a maverick, right? I mean, you know, some people think all these hedge fund guys are a bit wacky. You know, the Michael Lewis book is a fantastic piece of storytelling and has a lot of truth in it. But there's more to the truth than that. In other words, it's not just that you have eccentric people doing this stuff. It's that actually, if you go and speak to John Paulson, who is by far the most important hedge fund guy who made this anti-subprime bubble bet, if you actually look at him, he's not remotely eccentric. He's a very doer sort of, you know, numbers-driven guy. And the important thing he did was not to be eccentric, but to do research, to invest, in fact, $2 million on buying the most detailed set of statistics on historical house price behavior, warehousing those statistics in an outside computer company because he didn't have the data storage capacity in-house, hiring new analysts to look at these data to figure out what the past told you about the future. So you had to do serious work over a period of months, spending $2 million on it, to come up with the conviction that you were going to bet against this bubble and thereby, of course, reduce the size of the bubble. So I think, you know, that's my point on being the policeman, that you need hedge funds with the right incentives to go and do the hard work of becoming contrarian. But, you know, you also raised the important issue about social inequality, and I want to talk about that too, which is, I mean, I make a distinction between my support for hedge fund trading as a healthy thing in markets and the amount of money that hedge fund managers end up going home with. I mean, I call my book More Money Than God for a reason. There are ungodly sums of money being made. When J.P. Morgan, the famous banker, died in 1913, he was known as Jupiter for his godlike power over Wall Street. And his total fortune in today's dollars was $1.4 billion. Some of the people in my book make $1.4 billion in 1 year, right? Mm-hmm. So they made more money than Jupiter, i.e. more money than God, in a single year. Now, this is just disproportionate. So I think we should tax hedge fund managers' profits a lot more. There's a tax dodge they have, whereby they claim that their income is really a capital gain and they should be taxed at the lower capital gains rate. I think we should get rid of that loophole. So I'm deeply in favor of hedge funds as risk managers. I'm not saying that we should just tolerate the amount of money they take home.
What do you think should be the driver of capital investment that's productive generally for the society? Because in the end, you know, you have capital doing not a good job, hedge funds pointing in a contrary direction, but it doesn't necessarily lead to the kind of productive investment that we want to make. And the picture that emerges is one in which we can't trust the government regulators and maybe the politicians to actually build coalitions that will push the country in the right direction so the capitalists are investing in the right places.
Well, I guess, yeah, I don't have much faith in the government to start directing capital and picking, you know, which sectors of the economy should get it. I think, you know, private individuals who are paid to get that thing right and make money if they get it right are more likely to just do the sheer work and deploy the resources you need to deploy to get that difficult capital allocation thing right. And, you know, venture capitalists in California, you know, are everybody's favorite example. You know, they have done a good job of supporting Silicon Valley startups, and that's been great for the economy. So, you know, maybe the next wave comes with alternative energy, with biotech. A lot of the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, the venture capitalists, have moved in that direction. So I think we shouldn't be too pessimistic. You know, I think the private capital markets do get some stuff right. And certainly would be better than government-directed money.
Would hedge funds play a role here at all? Or
they do play a role, but it's an indirect and subtle one. And the role is basically that for the venture capitalists to put money in a startup or in a youngish company, they need an exit. They need to be able to think to themselves, in 5 to 6 years' time, we can do an IPO and list this on a tradable market. Otherwise, they won't do it in the first place. So they depend on the tradable market. The tradable market, in turn, depends on there being traders who trade in it. If it's not a liquid market with lots of stuff going on, lots of action, that market won't be attractive to list stocks. So by trading actively and often in a short-term way in public markets, the hedge funds actually do encourage private capital formation by venture capitalists.
One final question. What would you like audiences, the lay public, to be left with? Because they're going to go out and read your book, and there's a lot in the book. So what is there one central idea that or conclusion that you've come to?
I suppose the thing that, in the end, that sticks with me is less a policy conclusion and just a sense that, you know, to be a hedge fund manager, you have to think to yourself that you're smarter than the market consensus, that the weighted average of lots of people's opinion expressed in today's price is wrong, that you're smarter than that. And to have that belief, you've got to be a very self-confident individual. And so this sector has attracted over the years larger than life figures. Some of them have come from physics, from computer, from code breaking, from computer science. Others have come from sort of philosophy. Others have been very good kind of charismatic leaders of men who have gone off and, you know, hustled their way into understanding more about which corporation is well managed than the other one. So there's a variety of people and lots of different hedge fund styles. And it's the fascination of how each of them in their different way have beaten the market. That's the thing that endures with me as I think about my book.
Well, Sebastian, on that note, I want to thank you for taking the time to come to Berkeley and be on our program. Let me show your book again. And there was a limit to what we could cover here, but I think we've pointed your potential readers to go out and buy it.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.